All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How are you? Are you guys all right? Did you keep all your fingers? Are the kids okay? How'd your dogs recover from the fireworks? The cat's all right? Is your hand okay? Did you treat that burn? How's your toe? Maybe you should be careful next time when you're outside with no shoes on. What do you think, right? I'm sorry that your pie didn't work, he said to himself. My pie didn't work. Yeah, I'm talking. This is me talking. And I almost lost my fucking mind. You know, there's so few things we have control over. And it turns out that baking a pie is just another one of those things that we have limited control over. I just wanted a pie to work. It was an interesting turn of events on the 4th of July. I don't know how yours went. But here's what. I was invited to a party that I go to almost yearly. I haven't been there in a couple of years because it hasn't happened. My buddy Dan, Gimme Gimme Dan, from Gimme Gimme Records, and his wife Jen, the acupuncturist, have a party up in up where they live, where you can see all the fireworks in the neighborhood, my old neighborhood, and it was all going to happen. So, I happened to be going through Whole Foods the day before, the Sunday before the 4th of July, picking up a few things to make the pie that I was going to bring to the party from Whole Foods. I text Jen, and I'm like, "You want me to bring some brisket?" And I was thinking about this other piece of brisket in the freezer. It was just a flat, not the whole brisket. I thought I'd throw it on, just bring it. She goes, "Yeah, sure." And then I bought that big brisket. I'm like, "Fuck it, I'll bring the whole thing, the full brisket." So the next day, and this is all I'm coming around here to introducing my guest, because he comes up in this story, and I'll introduce him. Then I'll tell you who it is. All right, it's the way I'm going to do it today. So, Monday morning, I get up at 5 and, 4:15 actually, the day of 4th of July, and I pull that brisket. The night before, I salted and peppered it. That's all I did. Half and half, salt and peppered it. That's the rub. Next morning, I wake up 4:15, pull it out of the fridge, go back upstairs. Come downstairs at like 5:45. I get the Traeger going. 225 super smoke, and I put the brisket on there, and it's in there for about an hour and a half, and I get a text from Jen, the party's canceled. So now I've got an 11-pound brisket smoking in the Traeger, and I got to have a party. I got to pull a party together. I got to get it going. So I texted friends or people that I wanted to come over. It was sort of a scramble in a way. But the first guy I text is Jerry Stahl, my dear friend Jerry Stahl, the writer. And his girlfriend, Zoe, I'm like, "You guys want to come to eat some brisket?" And he immediately was like, "Yeah, what time? What do you need? Anything?" Now, I'll do this now, but Jerry Stahl's on the show today. One of my closest friends, out of the three, is Jerry Stahl. And he's the guy with boots on the ground here in L.A., out of my close friends, out of my two or three close friends. He's my bestie right here in L.A. Now, you may know Jerry Stahl. He's written quite a few books, 10 to be exact, among them Permanent Midnight, I, Fatty, Plainclothes Naked, many books. He's written for Esquire magazine, New York Times, Vice, The Believer. He's been around, man. Been writing a long time. Television writer, films. He wrote Hemingway and Gellhorn, written for CSI. He did work on Escape from Dannemora, that Ben Stiller produced thing with Benicio and the Arquette lady. He received an Emmy nomination for that. And now he's got this new book out, 999, N-E-I-N, One Man's Tale of Depression, Psychic Torment, and a Bus Tour of the Holocaust, which is a disturbing memoir as he takes a bus tour to all the major concentration camps. But Jerry is a dear friend. Truly one of my best friends. I'll talk about that more in a minute. But the party, I invited Dana Gould and his fiance, Kat. I invited Kevin Christie and his girlfriend, Marcel. I invited Lara Bites and her boyfriend, who I've only met once, but he couldn't come. But those were, that was the core group, and I fucking made this brisket. I was just going to bring something to a barbecue, and I ended up smoking a brisket for 10 and a half hours, doing it the Aaron Franklin way, wrapping it midway through, taking it off, putting it in a towel, putting it in a beer cooler so it stayed hot until people came over. I made a chess pie, and you know, here's how I know my brain's working pretty well. I'm cooking all day long, and I notice that, you know, a third of a cup, the plastic scoop for a third of a cup is dirty. I'm like, what did I use that for? There was no call for a third of a cup. And I realized, like, oh, fuck. And I knew the pie looked a little weird. The pie was fucked up. It was all runny. It was fucked up. I mismeasured something. So the pie was toast. The pie was garbage. Kit, cat lady Kit, obviously came. I make this pie for her because she likes the chess pie. I like it too, but she loves it. I was so fucking mad that it didn't come out. I can't even begin to tell you how fucking mad I was that it didn't come out. Can't even tell you. Beside myself that I fucked it up like that. And I just took that opportunity to beat the shit out of myself and see the world in a negative way. That didn't take much work. So the pie goes right in the garbage. She was like, can we still eat it? I'm not presenting that pie. It's garbage. It's garbage. And I don't have time to cook another one. So then I reached out to everyone who was coming. Bring some dessert. It all worked out. Everybody came over. The brisket came out perfect. I made a salad as well. And I cooked a big piece of salmon on a plank. And it was fucking beautiful. The brisket was amazing. Everybody enjoyed it. Before I go on, thanks to everyone who signed up for WTF Plus. You can click on the link in the show description or by clicking on the WTF Plus links at WTFpod.com. And for everyone else, I hope you're enjoying the hundreds of new episodes we put in the free feed. For future WTF Plus bonus material, I want to start doing more listener mailbags. Remember? You know what those are. Listener mailbags. It's a classic. Listener mailbags. So send me some stuff. Email me. Maybe I'll read it and talk about it on the mic. Our email is WTFpod@gmail.com. I guess I'm going to get some trolling. But sometimes those are all right. So let's talk about Jerry. Can we? Jerry Stahl has been there for me for many years. We've been friends. Jesus. It goes back now. It really does. I remember when I got here to L.A., I met him at one of the secret society meetings. And I was familiar with him, but I'm like, I want to be this guy's friend. You ever been in that position where you're sort of like, I wonder if I could be that guy's friend? And as a grown up, that's not easy. And I don't know how long it took for, you know, I would see him at meetings. I'm trying to be cool because it struck me that Jerry Stahl was probably the darkest, coolest motherfucker around, you know? And I was new in town and I would see him around. I'm like, God damn it, man. I want to be friends with that guy. That guy's got to have some dark wisdom. And I think I started pestering him. You know, I'd see him, you know, just sitting in the back at a thing. And I'd be like, hey, what's up? You know, and I'm just trying to be cool. And I don't know where it turned, but we just became closer. And I just started, you know, became around sobriety. And I started calling him and stuff. And I'll tell you, man, the evolution of a friendship, it's wild. It's wild, really. Because I wouldn't have never known, you know, that we'd be as, you know, get as close as we've gotten, you know, because, you know, we're difficult guys. He's not the easiest guy in the world to get to know. But it just started to evolve. And I'll tell you, you know, when I got divorced that second time, I was at the end of my fucking rope. And that guy, Jerry Stahl, talked to me every fucking day. Every day. After my wife left me, there were a couple of people that I would talk to. Every day, he'd fucking talk me off the ledge. Every fucking day. Never forget that when somebody shows up for you for real. For fucking real, man. You know? When everything's on the line. He's around when I started the podcast. And we had a deal together at HBO to create a show that we came up with, and we were going to write it together. And this was like right before the writer's strike. This is sort of the luck of it all. You know, we wrote this amazing script. I liked it. And poor Jerry, he was at that time still full of the Hep C and struggling daily with the exhaustion of that and the sickness of that. And then the writer's strike hit. And I just remember we couldn't write nothing. And then he just leaned into writing this novel, The Painkillers. Massive book, almost killed him. I would talk to him. But Jesus, it was almost killing him. We couldn't write the script. And I remember I didn't talk to him about this in the interview, but we haven't really fought. We had one fight where I talked to him with the wrong tone during the process of writing the script. I just remember, man, he snapped on me so hard. I was like, oh, fuck, there it is. Let's not open that door again. But it taught me a lesson, man. You know, it's like you talk to people with respect, even when you're aggravated. People don't work for you. We were working together. But we worked hard on that thing, and then the writer's strike happened. He wrote a novel, and when, you know, the writer's strike ended, they changed people at HBO, and we no longer really had anyone in our corner. It just went away. But that story in that pilot script showed up in the show Marin on IFC, which Jerry wrote with me. Jerry was on several seasons of my TV show, writing for that show. And I don't know, man. It's just, he's definitely, I love the guy, one of my closest friends. For sure. Been with me through divorce, like hands-on, and through the death of my girlfriend, and through, you know, just, you know, day-to-day struggles. And then eventually it became sort of a kind of a fun two-sided, you know, friendship. And get a lot of laughs, go out and do some stand-up. He'll come out with me. It's just like, you know, over the years, this was a guy who I met so many years ago. I just wanted to be his friend. And I didn't think I would ever get a laugh out of him. And now we just fucking crack up all the time. And now he's written this great book, this concentration camp tour memoir. And I think it's probably his third time on the show, but there was always sort of this sticking point of like, I don't know if he ever felt like he got his full episode. And this is finally, after so many years, my best friend Jerry's full episode. And I'm glad we finally got to talk. We always talk. Jerry and I always talk. It's just like, I know that there was some part of him that was hung up on this idea that the first interview we did was like, it was back when the show had three acts. Then the second one was just a shorter interview to promote, I think, OG Dad. But, you know, this is the time. This is the full treatment for Jerry Stahl on the release of this book, 999. So listen, Jerry Stahl's book, 999, One Man's Tale of Depression, Psychotic Torment, and a Bus Tour of the Holocaust is available now wherever you get books. And this is it. This is the big talk with my good friend Jerry Stahl. What are you doing with your phone? You must put your phone outside or you can put it in a bush.
Then I'll find it later. I swear I will.
You can put it in a bush and then go, wait, where'd I put it? Go put it in your wheel well.
Did that with drugs so many times. I'm like,
what?
You know,
oh, hiding it
down in MacArthur Park. Yeah, I know exactly which bush I'm hiding this under. And then you go back and you're finding like fucking condoms and you know, somebody
and
else.
The guy who watched you hide it is sitting
he's
next to there. Smiling.
Doing it right in front of you.
Yeah. How's the timbre of my voice in your head? Loud or is it all right?
The timbre is spectacular.
Oh, good.
And my lisp is coming through, so that's good.
No, you need that. That's what indicates you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in lisp denial in real life, but
I have one too, dude.
No, you don't.
I do.
So don't have a lisp.
I do have a lisp. I have a lisp. It's a mild lisp, and I roll my R's.
Well, that's kind of hot.
It's not. It's if I focus on it, it drives me nuts.
I don't even know what rolling your R's means.
I don't do. Is it L's or R's? L, la, la, la. I roll my L's, which just means I don't use my tongue for my L's. I don't go la, la, la. I do it for my throat and I go la, la, la. So it's really a W. So rolling.
All due respect, I'm not hearing a W, but.
No, I know. You don't hear it. I've been doing it all my life. I've adapted. But if I was, you know, I'm not going to get any of Sam Elliott's gigs. doing voiceovers, I think, primarily.
You know, at some point in life, you just got to accept what's not going to happen.
Yeah.
You're not getting Sam Elliott's gigs. I mean,
there's a lot of things.
Chalk it up, man.
No Peabody's. No Peabody's for me.
You know what?
What?
I think you're speaking too soon with the Peabody.
Oh, fuck.
I know a couple people on the committee.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not
they
like,
talk about you constantly.
I don't think I would, at this point, because I've gone past the point of like, well, we should have gotten one. I'm okay with it too. Like, fuck them.
Yeah.
I doubt they'll give me a Peabody.
Well, it's the experience I've had with both publishing and show business, you know, failing all genres being my motto. It's like, I fucking love this, but I mean, we would never, ever do this. But I mean, I fucking love, I showed it to my wife.
Yeah.
Oh, we were laughing our ass off. But
she couldn't stop laughing.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. There's no future for this.
Yeah.
Anywhere.
I mean, and not only that, but are you okay?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the one, the sympathy one. I find that when I'm on stage sometimes, I just see people who are too close to the stage who are just looking at me like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a sad thing, but it is. Like, if I let myself kind of get in that moment, I'm like, you're right. You're seeing the correct thing.
Yeah, well, I've seen the close sitters and how they're affected sometimes at the comedy store.
I'm not feeling that sad last night. I kind of ripped it up last night a little bit. And I don't know. I have found some, I don't know if it's new courage, but there's certainly nothing to lose anymore. You know, after this, the tossing out of the Roe v. Wade, and what is it, the Dobbs decision? Is that what they call it? What is it?
Yeah.
So, you know, I just started doing that material about abortion, and it was.
Are you talking about Angel Factories?
Yeah, the Angel Factories, and then I've
so
added some stuff.
Good.
But like, how'd you respond to this this Roe v. Wade thing? How did it affect you?
Well, you know,
because we're dudes, I get that. But like, it seems to me, like I've been saying on stage, we've all at some point kicked in for one of these.
Oh, I mean, look, I'm just going to say that I've done enough. There's actually a seat with my name on it at the Inglewood Women's Clinic.
Yeah,
you know.
Okay.
So and
yeah,
you know, I'm not bragging. Things happen.
Yeah,
yeah, you know. And some of them were probably mine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
we just want to help
out. I'm not always a mark.
But it's just interesting that there's not a lot of male voices, and you know, myself included.
No, there should be, though.
But yeah, because like there is no bigger proponent for the right to choose than panicky men.
No, that's the irony.
It's a different intent. It's a different reason.
That is the irony. I think we should be at the front of the line in every march because there is an equal. We don't have the same kind of skin in the game. But
right,
absolutely there.
Yeah, it's just weird when people frame it as a woman's issue. And like, I don't know, lately, well, I don't know about you, but like I've something sort of shifted in my capacity for empathy in general, you know, around, I don't know, it maybe had something to do with Lynn passing or whatever, but I'm also able to see women in a more full context somehow. Like I can empathize in a way that I don't think I was able to for whatever
Well,
reason,
sometimes life will drop kick you into enlightenment.
Yeah. And I think it's
a horrible price to pay.
When all you're thinking about is fucking them, the empathy is limited. It's tempered.
Well, I suppose it depends, you know.
Yeah, I guess so.
On
like what the feelings.
Yeah.
What the feelings are. But like I did feel like you know, an incredible despair for just the fact that they, you know, that more than half the population is sort of robbed of their, you know, physical autonomy.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, and the specifics, the 15-year-old raped by her father, the 12-year-old raped by her bro.
Right.
And has to carry it.
Yeah.
And have a kid. And that's it for her life.
Yeah.
She's done.
But like, I found myself despondent. And like, I've been waking up. This is like, you know, between us and like, you know, and I've talked about it vaguely before, but like my brain, like I woke up this morning, you know, with an hour of suicidal ideation.
That's why we're friends.
Like, I don't feel, you know, like all of a sudden the distance between suicide, thinking about it and doing it, it doesn't even seem that dire. Do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't, it's not that I'm like.
Do I know what you mean?
Yeah, it's not like I'm planning it, but I'm saying it's sort of like, there's just a disposition that's not even fundamentally depressed. It's just.
That's right.
Like, sort of like, I can't even explain it to you.
No, it's like, yeah, of course. Yeah.
It's just a matter of time.
It's not, what time is it now? It's just, it's not drama.
Yeah.
It becomes like, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what keeps me from doing it, and, you know, this is one of the few defining rules of my life, is, you know, the blood sprays on a living.
Yeah.
So you're fucking everybody. You might be out of it.
Yeah.
Although, who knows?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just a terrible thing to do to people.
Yeah, the thing is, like, I always think that. It's like, yeah, I'll be gone. But then, like, the only thing that
will
hangs...
Will you, though?
Yeah, but the only thing that hangs with me is, like, if I'm not going to be gone, I'm just going to be a disembodied consciousness.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's just sort of like, oh, fuck, now where am I?
And what do you do when you're a disembodied, you know, how ectoplasmic, depressed chunk of consciousness?
I'm assuming I won't feel fat.
Can you really assume that?
I don't know. If I don't have a point of reference.
I mean, I love the cockeyed optimism, but I don't know that. Who said ghosts can't? I mean, you know.
I don't know if it's because, a ghost thing.
But it's a feeling. The key word was feel.
Yeah. Feel. I know. But like, if you're not looking at yourself and there's nothing to pinch and you don't have limbs or hands.
I mean,
or,
look at Casper. He was a little plump.
Yeah,
he,
but that,
he was friendly.
I'm assuming that you're not going to. I'm not thinking there's going to be a body. Like, I don't think there's going to be, I'm just thinking it's going to be a presence.
But you're talking about feeling, so you're going to have something.
So it's going to be even more expensive.
Maybe all you have left is your sense of grotesque
self-awareness.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, this is it.
That's real hell. That's real hell.
That's total. Forget Sartre. Hell is other people.
All you know.
Hell is dying and feeling fat.
Exactly. We figured it out.
Yeah.
But you come from suicide. I come from a guy that never shut up about it.
Yeah. Well, different techniques. I mean, yeah. I mean,
just drag the living down with you while you're alive.
So much worse.
Because it never ends.
Never ends.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, the stories you tell about your father sitting there at breakfast with a bowl of cereal and a gun.
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, look, it's hard to say who wins in this situation.
Well, I mean, at least you got closure. My fucking dad's still
total
alive.
Total closure.
It's just like his brain is dribbling out of his ear.
Well, that's a whole other issue.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, lucky me, at 16, I had an excuse to feel as fucked up, depressed, alienated, and self-loathing and weird as I already felt.
Yeah.
But now it's like, lucky me, I can blame the like garage door and carbon monoxide situation. And
that was your dad?
Yeah, I dined down, you know, I dined out on that baby.
Yeah.
You know?
But like, did you find him?
No, I wasn't living at home at that point.
How old were you?
I was 16.
And you were already gone?
I had been shipped off to a Episcopalian school.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
From Pittsburgh?
From Pittsburgh, yeah. Same place Oliver Stone went, not to brag. Couple of the Bush kids.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it was weird.
How'd you end up there?
I had never even seen a stereo.
Yeah.
And it was all these, like, rich fucks.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, really?
And, you know, you want to talk about being the only Jew? We had to go to chapel every day.
Yeah.
So I just started doing
acid. Which school? You did?
Yeah, looking at the stained glass.
What year was that?
Wow. Talk about dribbling out of your ears.
Yeah. What year was that?
It was senior and junior in high school.
Wow. So what, 16?
I don't know if you were born yet.
I think
I got out of high school.
You're only
10
years older than me.
Let's see. High
71.
School would have been 16. I think it's like 1970, 71, 72 I got out of high school. Yeah.
You're like exactly 10 years older than me.
That's right. Yeah, to the day.
Yeah.
You're 27th, I'm 28th.
Right. So
that's why we have we celebrate our birthdays. Like
that's
that.
Right. Yeah.
You're going to kill yourself? Nah. Let's wait another year.
Just maintaining the balance. You know what I mean? That fine balance between thinking about death and doing death.
Yeah. You just don't. I think I would fuck it up.
That'd be bad.
Well, I think I told you about that story with this guy I met when I was teaching at San Quentin for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
This guy got in a lot of trouble. He tried to off himself.
Yeah.
Fucked up.
Yeah.
Blew the bottom half of his face off.
Yeah.
And then gets busted for a third strike on weapons possession.
Really? Because of the suicide
attempt?
Because
of that. And then does life with like half a fucking face.
It's the worst. There's no end to the possibilities.
And there's no guarantee.
Horror.
I'm not living horror. I'm not good mechanically.
Yeah. No. I don't feel like either of us are going to do it. I'm just like, it always concerns me that my brain does that as a soothing mechanism. I mean, really, it's like when I feel hopeless.
It's almost like it's philosophical self-medication.
Yeah. If I feel hopeless, it makes me feel better.
Sure.
Yeah. And I guess it's probably not that unusual.
No.
So when you're at the prep school, which prep school was it?
It was called the Hill School.
Where is it?
Pottstown, PA. My father, he didn't make it out the year, but he was living like in Philly
Yeah.
half the time.
Yeah.
and mother was in Pittsburgh, and not really getting along with, you know, mom had her issues. A little bit of electroshock action. You know.
She did that too?
Oh, yeah.
So you come from, well, I know this. I'm just saying that for the sake of the interview. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the battery would like drain. You know.
Oh, so the electroshock would work?
It would work for a little while, and then the battery would run down, you know. Why am I laughing?
Because you have to. Yeah. What else are you going to do? You know, it's like you have to keep from crying.
Well, it's like Hemingway said, you know, the greatest gift an artist can have is an unhappy childhood. So lucky fucking us.
Let's not bring him up as a point of an aspiration.
No.
The guy who ate a fucking shotgun. Isn't that what he did?
Yeah, he ate a fucking shotgun because he had electroshock.
Yeah.
And his memory started to go. This is shit I wanted to put in that fucking HBO movie, but...
Yeah.
And his memory started to go, and he was supposed to write a speech for Kennedy, of all things.
Uh-huh.
JFK.
Yeah.
And he couldn't remember anything. And he couldn't write anymore.
Oh, that's what, what happened?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, at least they didn't get the lobotomies.
No.
I mean, my dad had electroshock. Like, you know, in the last 5 or 6 years. I'm just saying
In the last 5 or 6 years?
Well, yeah, there was a period there where they do it differently. It's not...
No, I think it's much more, I don't want to say benign.
It's not Nicholson style. I think they might even put you out to do it. Yeah, I think.
I once heard, and this could be mythic, but I once heard that Bernardo Bertolucci did it recreationally.
Yeah, okay. Those Italians, I guess.
Yeah, you know.
I don't know if that's a
party down.
I think there's. Yeah. I don't think there's any stereotype there.
Hit the juice
I just
talk.
Like
no.
Those Italians.
What does that even mean? That's so not even applicable.
Yeah, like if it were the French,
but you know what? You said it fast. It. So,
yeah. Well, I was thinking French. You know, because the French.
Did, come on. Mon Dieu.
Well, what came to mind was who was that? Who was the artist that could. Come just by thinking about it? Was it Cocteau? I think Cocteau came to mind for some reason.
Cocteau?
Yeah, Cocteau.
He did that? He could make himself come just by thinking?
Yeah, I think that was the guy.
That could be messy.
And I think that, but I think it was Burroughs referenced it. Like there's a lot of connections.
How did I not know
but
that?
But for some reason, I don't know, I guess we could look it up. Like my brain went to Cocteau, Man Ray, and then all of a sudden you said that Bertolucci liked electroshock therapy.
You know
so
what, I have to give that with a caveat. I mean, I could
what
be
do you
wrong.
Know?
Somebody told me that. Yeah.
So, okay. So
doesn't keep me from saying it.
No. So I don't think I got this backstory. So you're doing acid at the prep school with the
rich kids.
Scions of the American aristocracy.
Yeah, some of them. A lot
Did
of them.
I use that
yeah.
right?
It's one of those words I've written.
Scions?
Scion?
Is it
cyborg?
Scions?
I have
Scions?
No fucking idea.
But they're the...
It's S-C-I-O-N.
Right. But they're the legacy.
Sure.
Yeah.
The kids of the kids.
Yeah.
A lot of fail sons.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The kids who like get sent there. And,
Yeah.
I think...
Hope it works out.
I think Bissell.
Bissell.
You know, Richard Bissell kids.
Yeah.
You know, vacuum cleaner.
Mm.
Defense.
Yeah.
You know, that combo.
The Bissell crew. They
the
were
Bissell
there.
Bissell crew, yeah.
You knew that guy? You knew that kid?
I knew a Bissell. And I seem to remember the nice guy, but my memory's a little shaky because I was doing mescaline every fucking day and acid and shit, you know.
In high school?
Yeah.
Where's the mescaline coming in from? That seems kind of exotic.
Oh, you know, we're getting it from Philly, from UPenn.
Right, because if you got the rich kids are going to get
rich
you the
kids
shit.
Can get
so
anything.
You got it from the labs in Philly? From the labs in UPenn?
I don't know where they made it.
But this was the old-timey acid, right? This was
the
real acid.
Yeah, it's old-timey acid. And then once I was a senior, and all those guys are just like going to college in Philly at Penn.
Yeah.
I mean, forget about it.
Yeah.
You know, I would just go out there and stay overnight and then come back and
Did you do college?
I did college, yes. I attended Columbia, thank you.
Yeah.
And dropped out.
So that worked out? The prep school helped you?
Oh, yeah. I am, look at me, I'm an academic.
You are an academic.
Absolutely.
You've done some teaching. You've written some books.
I've done a couple things.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
But so when you go to Columbia, is that so that's 19...
Yeah, it was like the Vietnam War era.
You know, 72?
Yeah.
How'd you avoid the draft?
I'll tell you exactly how I avoided the draft. I didn't avoid the draft. My number was 73. That's back when they had the lottery.
Yeah.
And it ended that year, I believe, in the 50s. I made no plans whatsoever.
So you almost went.
Well, you know, there's always the guys who like stick peanut butter in their crack and then get down there and
then
eat
act crazy.
They get down there and like scoop it out and
eat
it in front of the guy.
How many times did the draft board have to see that shit before were like, hey, it's another shit eater?
I mean, bring it, you know, bring toast. What's going on? Yeah, what is it with these kids?
Yeah, here we go with the fucking shit eating.
We've seen it, buddy. Try apple butter next time.
I don't know.
Yeah. So I,
no plan.
I made no plans and ended up dropping out anyway for a year or two.
Yeah.
Going to Europe, doing that whole thing, being a bartender in London, living in a cave in Crete. I never talk about this shit.
A cave?
Yeah, and Matala. There was like a bunch. It was like the tail end of the hippie era. You can't do that shit now.
Were you long hair?
My hair doesn't get long.
Uh-huh.
It just gets wide, and then I can't fit through a door.
The Jufro.
I look like the Ace of Spades.
So you go to Columbia.
I have wide hair.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
flat
on top. It's kind of the Larry Fine.
I have that too. Yeah, mine does that too. Yeah.
Oh, you have great hair, man. What are you talking about?
Well, I keep it trim, but like it's flatter and on top, and then the sides will bush out.
Really? You got the side frizz?
Yeah. But
we should start a band.
It's called Side Frizz. That's what the world needs now. Some more, you know, aging Jews playing rock music like they mean it.
Yeah. Well, they're out there.
But, you know, so before, so there was a time where, you know, you were caught up in the times and you were at Columbia and you were like on the road to some sort of artistic kind of within the margins life.
Kind of. I remember taking over a building with some sort of nebbishy guy, and we're in like the dean's office or something, and he sees his file.
Yeah.
And he opens it.
Yeah.
And they have like an assessment, and it's like great filler material.
What do you mean? What does that mean?
That means he's nothing special. But the guy was really depressed.
That's what it said in his file?
That was their list. It's like, you need some of these.
Was that
guys.
High school or college?
Well, that was the college's assessment of him for admission.
Mm.
And they're thinking, we need a little filler material.
Yeah, we need one of these guys. The guys are just in the middle. They're just kind of...
just like, they're not going to make waves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so what happened? So you go to Europe when you're at college?
I dropped down to Europe. But, you know,
I dropped out for
a while and then went back and finished FAFSA. So basically, I started writing for The Voice. You know, it's really what I wanted to do, just be in New York, be a writer.
Right.
You know, I wasn't exactly.
Right. Who's at The Voice at that time?
Who was at The Voice?
Like Nat Hentoff?
Was Nat Hentoff still at The Voice?
It
was
still,
like it Guy Trebe. Elliot Fremont Smith was my book editor.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened to him. And not great with names. I mean, so, Mailer started it, but he was way gone.
Mailer did?
Yeah.
And this is what, 73, 74?
You know, the date thing, man. You're hitting me with chronology.
No, I know, but I'm just trying to figure it out.
It's around there, yeah.
Because you graduated 70s. High school, 71, 72.
I think I staggered out of college a year later than I should have in like 76.
Okay. So New York was on the rebound a little.
New York was pretty intense.
Yeah.
I mean, the 70s in New York, it was like the thing on the subways when it's like the wolf pack. It's like, on the one hand, it's a bunch of little kids, like 14-year-olds.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's seven of them and they got blades.
Right.
And there's no way to look cool.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're going to take your shit.
Yeah. So that happened?
Oh, yeah. Oh. Yeah.
And what about, like, so were you doing the downtown thing? Were you hanging out?
Well, you know,
it
was the punk era.
Yeah,
and,
was it for real?
I knew a guy I went to grade school with.
Yeah.
Who's since passed. He was the, like, first drummer for Blondie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I would go to CBGB and see some of that shit. And then we did acid together. And then it fucked him up. He dropped out, worked in, like, I don't know, like a garbage can factory or something in Pittsburgh. In 30s, and blamed me.
That's the kind of business.
And blamed me.
That they had in Pittsburgh.
Became like a chemist.
Yeah
something.
Yeah.
He was a top dog in the garbage business.
Garbage can business.
Yeah.
He blamed you for losing his mind?
Well, yeah.
But you didn't lose your mind.
I don't know. You tell me. Here
no,
we are.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
So, back then, did you meet Toshis and those guys in that time?
I never met anybody cool in the day. I always met people later.
Right. And you were like, were you at that show? I was at that show. That kind of thing?
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I didn't go with the cool people. Yeah. I mean, I was in a lot of shit, but I was never a joiner.
Yeah.
So punk was happening.
Right.
I was down there. I saw it. I saw like Patti Smith trudging through the East Village.
Yeah.
Fucking big old boots and
you
shit.
You can still see that.
Yeah, absolutely.
She still does it.
And you don't even know if it's her.
Yeah.
Because there's so many people
she's so fucking great.
Oh, my God. The hair alone. Yeah, she's fantastic.
She's like, she's out there doing it, and you know, she means it. And she's full of love, like really spreading the joy. Seriously. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, you go to her shows, and it's uplifting and elating. Like, she's like... Like, well, so present.
Isn't that what people say when they leave your show? What they feel uplifted?
I don't know.
I think so.
Some of them say, did I say? What did I do? I don't worry about it.
Or your favorite that I always love. You know, is he okay?
Yeah. Is he okay?
Is he going to be all right? Should we wait?
Yeah.
I don't want an autograph. I just want to see if he's okay.
Well, you know, it gets pretty heavy in here, man. You know, I think they. I think most of them think I'm okay.
Oh, now you're totally okay. Now they wonder if they're okay.
But what are you covering in the 70s in New York? Like, what are you doing?
I'll tell you, the first story, I used to write for the New York Press, too.
Yeah.
This is no longer an acceptable word, but at the time, and forgive me, this is not an acceptable word. We'll just say there were shows, I think up in the Bronx, of Puerto Rican, we're going to say midget wrestling, little people wrestling.
Sure.
Because that's not a good word. Wrote about that. I wrote about, I covered the
weird
shit. It's
so funny when you ask somebody their first story, how are you ever going to forget?
Yeah.
Covering little people wrestling.
I can't.
Puerto Rican little people wrestling. It's very specific.
Very specific.
Was it a cultural phenomenon with the Puerto Ricans?
I don't think it was just Puerto. There are all kind of people there. And it was just like, wow, this shit is going on. I always like subcultures.
This shit is going down.
I love subcultures. And then I had kind of I never went to journalism school or anything. So I wrote a thing for The Voice about confession magazines. And remember, I don't know if you remember the
Apology?
True Confessions.
Oh, the cop ones, right. Yeah.
Apology, yeah.
There was a guy who did the Apology
line. I know the Apology hotline. Yeah. This was Confession Mags, and the woman wouldn't see me, you know, the main editor. So I ride an elevator with her, and I hear her say to one of her co-workers, as I slap them, my co-workers, right. The only difference between me and my readers is that my IQ is over 70.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so I put that in a story.
Nice.
Quoted her.
Fuck her.
Oh, no, man, that is not journalism ethics.
No.
I had to go and apologize. I mean, I just didn't even occur to me.
That you couldn't do that.
That I couldn't. I mean,
that
was
off the record. That you're eavesdropping.
Well, I'm on an elevator with some woman. I mean, she probably felt safe. And then I'm in there fucking, you know.
But she wasn't even talking to you, though.
Not even in the slightest. Didn't even know I was there. She did later. And then I heard from the editor, you want to work in this? Why don't you go fucking apologize?
Really?
Yeah, and I had to. I did.
You confessed?
I wrote a story, you know. I eavesdropped on the editor of this very magazine.
Yeah.
So that happened.
And when do you start?
It sounds prestigious, doesn't it? I mean, really ripping the lid off stuff.
Sure. Oh, it was powerful work.
Yeah. I was going deep.
I just realized, I think that the little people have been involved in wrestling since the beginning of wrestling. There's always been sort of like, you know, little people tossing and all that kind of weird.
Oh, that's a whole other thing. That started happening. Remember in the Rock videos and shit? And it was just...
Yeah.
That's a whole other level.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys had dignity.
They weren't covering music.
They were fucking tough. Did I cover music? I think I wrote about Rye Cooter. I started writing for the Santa Cruz Times for $8 an article.
When you come out here, though?
When I ended up out there later on.
So when did you go to the cave? When you were living in the
caves? Caves are when I dropped out of college. Didn't know if I was going back. I'm living in a cave in Matala.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why? Were you homeless or was it cool?
I didn't have a lot of money. It seemed like an interesting thing to do.
Were there other people living in the cave?
Yeah, a lot of old hippies had been there. So there was a lot of feces if you went too far back. And I remember I was with a bunch of British guys. And when they were gone, I looked at one of their journals. And he's like, I'm not going to do the accent. But I read it and it said, this weird American bloke has latched onto us. You know, and I felt like an idiot.
That was you?
That was me.
Oh.
Yeah.
So there are other people in the cave.
Yeah,
the time.
Yeah, it was like sleeping bag. You know, it was a hippie thing.
How long were you there in the cave?
I think I was in the cave for a couple of weeks.
Okay, all right. And then you worked in.
I don't think I qualify as a cave dweller.
No, not for a couple of weeks. You're definitely a cave tourist.
I wasn't absolutely. Yeah. Just passing through.
Yeah,
I wasn't getting my mail there.
Yeah. So and then you worked in a restaurant. You said.
I worked in London. I ended up. Let's see, where else did I live? Yeah, I worked at a place called the Brush and Palette in London, which is where you probably don't remember. There was something called the Profumo scandal.
No, I don't know anything about that.
Just some scandal, the typical shit involving prostitutes, this and that.
Okay.
But the gimmick at this restaurant was that they had a nude woman sitting in front of the diners with like a fake French guy and like the little beret painting him.
Yeah.
So I was like a dishwasher, so I just, you know, got the straight view.
Yeah.
But then I started, I was going out with the woman.
Who was
the model?
Right.
She was an American, I knew.
Yeah.
And you know, I felt I had conflicting feelings.
Right, about her doing the posing.
Yeah,
the...
I mean, but you know, you live, you learn.
Well, that was the first. That was the beginning of whatever the fuck you ended up evolving
just
into.
Just a stop along the way. It's all about acceptance, Mark.
Yeah. Acceptance. That's right. That's right.
Drinking a little too much. My head was the size of a basketball.
Because
I was working. You know, then I started working in a bar.
Yeah.
And you're living on like rashers. In and bangers and Guinness.
Yeah, yeah, rashers and bangers.
And don't get me started.
Yeah.
It's all sex with you. But you know the weird thing about that gig?
What?
Was every Sunday, all the pregnant ladies would come in to like hammer the fucking Guinness.
Oh, really?
Because they thought it was packed with iron.
Is it?
Sure.
I don't know what's in Guinness. It seems healthy. It looks healthier than most beer.
Oh, that was the real Guinness. You could put a spoon in that and it would just stand straight
up. Yeah, right.
That phone. It was intense.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So, but it's easy to be a bartender because there's really not a lot of mixed drinks.
Right. In England.
Yeah.
So when does the problem start?
You were taking me back.
I know.
When did the problem start?
Yeah.
Three. Four. when mom did the enemas.
Oh, yeah, we missed all that.
I'm just saying, when did the problem start?
Yeah, you were clean.
When did your problem start?
You were clean inside.
I was clean and sober.
Yeah, inside by your mom.
It's like you were talking the other day. Was it Ms. Berlant? Is that how you pronounce it? Yeah, about the colonics.
Yeah, the colonics.
Which is really weird.
Your mom was an early adapter.
She it was more like a turkey baster. It was like Harpo's horn. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And no lube. But it was weird. When I was over a couple of years ago in Poland, and all over like Krakow and also Berlin, you know, all these these like signs on little billboards like Kolonik. I don't know if I'm getting the accent right.
Sure. Good. Yeah. Oh, really?
Can you imagine?
It's a craze.
Get a fucking German colonic.
With that,
that's some primal shit.
Sure, with German instructions. I don't understand it, so it all seems primal to me.
Auf die Knie.
I know. Yeah, I didn't even do it right, but it's definitely kind of a, what was the word I want? There's a a lot of that. Guttural, is that what I want?
It's very guttural.
Yeah.
It sounds like the noise is coming. If you're like a men's room stall in Port Authority and somebody's, having like an emotional bowel movement in the next one, a lot of that.
But when does the, I know the age three, sure. I don't know when it's somewhere in there. But I mean, like, when were you writing for Goldstein or no?
I wasn't writing for Goldstein. I was writing fake sex letters. For Penthouse. That would have been Guccione.
Oh, shit. I probably read those when I was a kid.
My dad
used to buy Penthouse.
Yeah, that was me.
The fake.
That's all my early work.
I used to like Xavier Hollander's column.
Oh, yeah.
Call Me Madam. What it was called?
To the Happy Hooker.
The Happy Hooker, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she used to have a monthly column in Penthouse.
Call Me Madam.
I believe so.
Wow.
And it was just, it was a column that I remember reading when I was a kid.
Damn.
Because my dad got that shit.
Did it get you?
Like, yeah,
how old are we talking? Is that some early?
I don't know. It was probably 13, 14. You know. Yeah. Yeah. It was around the right time to start seeing that stuff.
So was your earliest jerk off material like pictures or reading dirty stuff?
I don't know if it was associated with anything.
Mm.
I think it was just associated with the feeling. But when I started to become conscious, it was mostly my brain thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But then it became, I think there were some pictures. Yeah. But it started off imagination.
Yeah.
And then someone got hold of a porn magazine. It was like, oh, my God, that's when you learn how everything works.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And then, I got a hold of these Elizabethan and Victorian era, porn, like The Pearl.
Mm.
And these weird stories, and Autobiography of a Flea.
Oh, what was that about?
Just these weird stories with, everybody was frigging. I didn't know what that meant. And it took
Autobiography,
me, like,
isn't like Alexander Pope or something?
I don't know, somebody. But, it took me, 2 years before I realized it wasn't public hair.
Oh, yeah.
It was pubic hair.
But isn't this literature? Isn't the Autobiography of a Flea, what is that?
Okay, it was... There were these paperbacks.
That's right. It's an anonymous erotic novel.
Yeah.
First published in 1887 in London by Edward Avery.
Nice.
I don't know what that means.
Well, might not have been him.
No, he didn't write it. He just published it. Oh, right. So that was the first of dirty books.
That was the, oddly, like my first dirty books were in weird Elizabethan English.
So you were just writing the fake letters to Penthouse?
I wrote the fake sex letters in Penthouse back and forth. I just go to the other side of my desk and write the answer.
Yeah.
My girlfriend is into scars. And then, the greatest hits. And then, I wrote for Beaver. Yeah. I mean, I was so naive.
Beavers, that was a lot of meat in that one.
a lot of pain. And I remember I was such an idiot. I wrote a story for them, and the guy said to me, don't you want to use a different name? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
He's like, you.
I'm proud.
Trust me.
Yeah.
Because I was just, I just wanted to be a writer so bad.
You wanted to be Jerry Stahl from Beaver.
Yeah, well, which I ended up being, so it all worked out. It looks good on a resume and it opens doors, is what I'm saying.
It opens something.
I'll say. Yeah. And it's not Sesame.
That was not one of the classier convenience store porn publications.
No.
Beaver Mag.
Well, then I ended up... how I got out of New York to L.A. with a brief 3-month stop at the YMCA in Columbus, not to brag, was that I got a gig as like a humor editor at Hustler.
Right.
Doing this thing called Bits and Pieces, where people would send in like pictures of like erotically shaped vegetables from Wisconsin.
Oh, really?
You know, and you'd have to write
those dirty Wisconsinites.
Oh, my God. Those cheesehead monsters. And, it's a classy gig.
And that's what got you here?
Yeah, 6 months to the day, I got fired by Paul Krasner, and of all people.
What the fuck did you have to do to get fired by that guy?
I don't know, but I did it.
Huh.
I did it. And Larry Flint had got shot. I mean, it was a lot of drama.
When you were there?
When I was in Ohio, he got shot, and then we moved out here. And, formed some lifelong associations.
What was in Ohio? When did the
that's where he was. He started out in Columbus.
So that's where he
had one party where he invited the whole staff to his house in like Beckley, which is this upscale section of Columbus, and in the basement, in a diorama, he recreated the shack where he grew up. Which I just thought, wow, that's money.
That's an ego right there. Wow.
That too.
Yeah. So when does the dope start?
When does the dope start? Well, dope was in and out. You know, I was always doing shit.
Yeah.
Somehow in my kind of a late bloomer, late 20s, 30s.
Yeah.
Again, chronology, sketchy.
Yeah.
I was just strung out.
Yeah.
You just realize you're fucking strung out.
Yeah.
And you're shooting dope every day.
Yeah.
And this was before AIDS.
Yeah.
So, I'm sharing needles and shit like an idiot. You know, we did the little like alcohol swab.
Right.
But I got the Hep C.
Yeah. I was thinking about that though, because I just watched this Karen Dalton documentary.
Oh, Karen Dalton. She's amazing.
Yeah.
What voice.
Oh, she's great. But like she was strung out. And I think Tim Harden got her strung out. But it was a problem. But the way they all talk about it, you get these old folkies talking about shooting speed and dope.
You're James Taylor you had in the show, right?
Right. But like I just can't picture it being so accessible and around that, there's just gatherings where people just hanging out booting dope that weren't like, because as it evolved, that became like a shooting gallery situation, but it seems like it was just a regular party and somebody would pull out the fucking works.
Slamming and jamming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there was, because to me, it always strikes me as something that's kind of sordid and fucking creepy. But I guess it wasn't at that time.
That's where it goes. I mean, I don't know. I never had folk parties where we were all
playing guitar.
Michael Row the Boat Ashore, you go. I missed that. But like so many movements, I just missed it. So the dope got a little sorted.
Folk dope,
fast.
You missed the folk dope parties?
I missed them.
Yeah.
It wasn't invited. They were probably going on. I lived in Laurel Canyon for a while. I heard some folk, but nobody invited me in. I was doing the crack by then, too.
Cracking dope?
Well, I was trying to get off the dope, so I thought I'd switch to crack.
To crack? Smoking the crack?
Yeah.
But both solitary.
Not the best decision I ever made.
Solitary adventures for you?
Oh, they were adventures.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's that story, where I thought I was getting arrested because I lived in the bottom half of a house.
Yeah.
And I'm coming back one night at 3 a.m. and the landlady's out there like waving her hands and the cops have pulled up and I'm like, I just kept going. I didn't pull over. Turned out, landlord had had a heart attack and needed a ride to the hospital.
And you bailed.
And he died.
Yeah. and you're running.
I didn't know I was evicted because I never opened my mail till finally she came downstairs. Why the fuck, are you still here?
Yeah. Wow.
Essentially, you killed
me. And that was in Laurel Canyon?
You killed my husband. Yeah, it was right across from Wonderland Elementary.
Mm.
So I would hear them sing. You know when you're up all night and it's not
That's
just the birds. It's kids singing, America, the
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, fuck.
Is it 5 days a week?
Is it 8 o'clock again?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I lived next to a school when
Oh, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but I was sober by then, but it was right over there. When I first moved to LA, it was right next to a school. It was the bells, the ringing of the bells.
Yeah, that's right. All day long, too.
I lived next to a place where they built a large building. That was when I was using in Somerville, Massachusetts. They
were doing heavy construction,
like pounding foundation.
Oh my! And
wake at 7 a.m.
Oh, and you got that coke head from the night before.
The worst.
The depression is unspeakable.
The worst, and it's shaking the house.
Yeah.
So you think you got the Hep C's in the 70s?
Well, yeah. I mean, I probably the 80s. Mm. You know, I got it. I mean, the guy I started out with, who ended up doing like weird movies with and stuff, like Cafe Flesh and stuff, he ended up having a liver transplant.
Which guy's that?
His name is Steven Sadian. He is a total genius. At 21, he sort of did all Flint's ads with those weird ad parodies and all those crazy covers and shit. Real, just a great guy. But, you know, he ended up having the transplant, you know, which is where Hep C goes. But somehow I got lucky because I was like... Also,
I know
shooting dope, jogging, and drinking wheatgrass.
Yeah,
so
sure.
you know,
gotta balance it.
I was covering the water
like a true Libra, just trying to keep the balance.
Does that make me a Libra? I guess we're Libras, right?
Yeah, and just kind of like balance.
I've never had balance.
Yeah,
I mean,
you strive.
The guy can dream.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good example: the wheatgrass and the running and the heroin.
Yeah, sure. You get a lot of people don't know this.
What?
But you can shoot dope and get a lot of energy because you just don't feel the fatigue.
Right.
I wasn't an otter.
Right.
I was a jogger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes.
Yeah.
And then, it went south.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of dudes that I used to see in the old, when I lived down there on 2nd between A and B that, they're.
Oh, you're doing the real thing with guys lowering the bag out the window.
Yeah. That was next door.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But like there were dudes that were old dudes that, I think if you maintain your habit, you'll be all right.
Sure.
But not now. You don't know what you're getting.
It's like Burroughs said, it's not the drug, it's the lifestyle.
Yeah.
It's what you got to do to maintain.
Right, the crime.
Yeah, whatever.
Right.
Yeah, whatever you got to do.
That's right.
You
know? That's what gets dangerous. Yeah. That, like I used to say that about drugs is that as soon as you get involved with them, you kind of exponentially are adding to the possibilities of ways you could die outside
Absolutely
of the drug.
True. And not just die, but fuck up. Because I relapsed a lot.
Yeah.
I was a guy at meetings like people didn't want to sit next to because they'd get like relapsosis. it took me a minute to lock in. But like as soon as you relapse, suddenly you lose your wallet.
Right.
Somebody T-bones your car. And it doesn't even seem like you're responsible for any of it. But just cosmically, it's like, fuck you.
You've opened.
You did this again.
Yeah.
You're fucked.
You're off your grid.
That's right.
And it's just chaos.
It's not safe.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So when
that's for the kids.
Yeah. So you come out here for Hustler and then but the thing about the Hep C, because I don't think we talked about that, was like, I mean, I knew you when you were dying. We were writing that thing for HBO and you were sweaty and pale.
Yeah.
And you were fucking it seemed like you were very sick.
Yeah.
And then the writer's strike happened, of course. It's just another Jerry story where it's like, we're close. No, writer's strike. And then you wrote Painkillers and it almost killed you.
Yeah. Well, that later down the line, I was clean then.
You were clean.
Yeah.
I mean,
but I was dying. And, I was told I had a year to live for a very long time.
And you were very sober. I mean, you were like 15 years sober or something more.
Yeah, well, the Hep C is weird because the main symptom is you feel kind of hungover and you're super tired. You're I remember you saying, we talked later about the Marin show. It's like, I couldn't hire you, man. You were kind of sweaty and green.
you were sick?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, not a guy you want to be around.
Well, it wasn't so much about being around you. It was just I didn't know if you were going to handle it.
No, you can't hire a guy who think might die 2 months in.
I don't know I don't remember it, but I remember you being sick because when we wrote that thing, you pulled out and then you almost killed yourself writing that fucking book, that huge Mengele book.
Yeah, that was weird. That was my first brush with the Nazis.
And that was about...
I've been going deep, rolling Nazi deep for a real long time.
That was a few books ago. It was a huge book and Mengele's still alive and he's in Highland Park. But I guess the point being is that now they can cure Hep C if you got the bread, but you were on a drug trial?
Yeah, I got really lucky.
You didn't get the placebo.
Well, no, because I defied doctor's orders for years.
About the getting the other stuff.
Yes.
What's it called?
Interferon.
Yeah, interferon.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it. Yeah. Because I knew somebody who killed themselves. A woman we know from the program had this crazy thing where she on Mulholland tried to kill herself.
Yeah.
Landed on all four wheels in
a pool.
Daytime soap star's driveway.
Uh-huh.
And just had to get out of the car and call AAA.
You know, my God.
And
also, it wasn't guaranteed that it was
worth. 30-40%. So,
right.
But they kept telling me I was going to die.
Yeah.
I mean, I paid like 20, when I, you know, because I had some dough back then.
Yeah.
I paid $25,000 to go to the Dominican Republic, get a bang of stem cells.
You did?
Which kept me alive for a year.
Really?
Yeah. It was wholly illegal, but, you know, a doctor I was seeing said, well, you know, I know a guy who knows a guy, but
yeah.
And it was really weird.
Yeah.
You know, when you go to the Dominican Republic for a day and come back and they're looking at you, you know, in customs.
Yeah.
Not easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I try, long story short, I get on this trial drug program at Cedars because I was interferon naive and, I get this drug.
You
want to talk about it? This is sort of an acid heavy episode, but it was doing bad acid.
Yeah.
I would drive, I had tracks because they were taking blood every couple of
and
days.
And you're 20 years sober, 15 years sober at that point.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it felt like I was doing bad acid.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would clutch the wheel and tell myself, the road is solid.
Yeah.
Because the freeway felt wavy, but it worked.
I think that's on a philosophical level. I think
it's solid?
It's words to live by.
It's worth pondering.
Road, something, if anyone thing is solid, let it be the road that we are walking.
But is it? Anyway, long story short, Abbott Pharmaceuticals, they came up short. I think it was so unpleasant and fucked up that even though in 1 week, it was zero. You know, they checked, it wiped me out. It was so atomic.
So this was
and
the
then
first,
you keep doing it for 12 weeks.
So, but this was the first version of this drug that's now readily available.
Yes, Harvoni,
which
is Jesus, I think it's 900 a pop or something.
Yeah.
Unless you're in Canada, in which case it's 12 or something.
Yeah, $12.
Yes,
yeah.
Not 1200. So I lucked out. It just fucking cured me. I mean, it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
But now if I'm creepy and sweaty, it's on the natch.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't blame Hep C.
Did you feel a relief? Did you feel
fuck yeah.
Shitting
me?
Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, because you feel I'm looking death in the eye. When you defy the doctors and don't do the shit they tell you to do.
Yeah.
And they're telling you you're going to die.
Yeah.
You know.
But yeah,
that's kind of an outlaw mode.
Well,
but then it was almost getting clean. I'm now I'm not dying.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now what?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, welcome.
Yeah.
What's your excuse now?
Yeah.
But
excuse.
But no, but you did.
And I had energy. I mean,
it changed
wild.
Yeah.
And I might be slightly green, but I wasn't
British
racing green.
No. Yeah, I think you look good. Your whole disposition eventually changed. You went out and had a new baby. You did
all kinds of weird shit happened. Yeah, but I mean, I got on that medicine.
Yeah,
I didn't know the my wife at the time was pregnant, and they said, oh, and by the way, if you so much as touch a pregnant woman with a drop of sweat, the kid will be born with antlers and a 3-day beard.
Wow.
You know, it was total mutant.
Yeah.
So she had to, the poor woman had to go move to Texas.
And, that was during that?
Because she couldn't be around the med. You couldn't even hold the pill. I mean, this stuff was beyond toxic, but that's why it worked.
Wow.
Yeah.
But I guess that the version they're using now is a little more manageable.
Oh, well, Abbott didn't get the gig.
Oh, really?
Somebody, the Harvoni people. I don't know.
Abbott have, now they got the COVID test gig.
Yeah. You know, they land on their feet.
Yeah. Abbott did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've used many of those COVID
tests. No, it's like IG Farben. Sure, they had slaves making their pills at Auschwitz.
Yeah.
But you know what? They did okay. Same with Bayer. They came through.
Bayer. Yeah. What? Bayer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also Braun, right? The machine.
Sure,
And my coffee grinder.
Hugo Boss. Every bar mitzvah boy's suit is Hugo Boss. Guess who designed the SS uniforms? And they were sharp.
They were
Hugo Boss.
Really?
Yeah, man. It never ends.
Yeah. So like,
I am such a boring font of this. And the great thing about this book, for what it's worth, is I got to, because I don't write in a linear, I got to march out a lot of this stuff that I love these crazy fucking details.
The rabbit holes. Well, I mean,
it is indeed a rabbit hole.
The first book was Permanent Midnight, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes on through, was it Perv a Love Story?
No, I think that.
Or Short Stories. One,
yeah, maybe. Yeah, I guess it was Perv a Love Story. Yes, it indeed was. And then Plain Clothes Naked.
That's right. That's the kind of noir one.
Yeah.
Then I Fatty, the genius I Fatty.
Yeah, which is still soon to never be a movie. You know, but
another
we tried.
Great Jerry show business story that well, doesn't quite land.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, God rest his soul, was the initial guy.
Who yeah. wanted to develop? He optioned it first?
Well, Johnny Depp optioned it
yeah.
for eternity.
Yeah. Okay.
So that happened.
Well, you need the bread. So there you go.
Yeah. I sure did. It all worked out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now it's in development hell, basically.
It'll be in development forever. That's yeah. part of the joy of projects like this.
But that's a great book because that was one of those things where when you have to do research on something, you'll fucking do it. Like the way you set up that era of Hollywood was, you know, so meticulous
mm-hmm.
because you were all up in it.
Well, this is the grim backstory to that, which is, you know, not to drop names, but,
yeah.
you know, old pal Bourdain, you know, was doing a series.
Anthony, yeah.
Anthony Bourdain was doing a series for Bloomsbury Books
and uh-huh.
of like nonfiction, sort of like unknown icons.
Yeah.
So he did one on Typhoid Mary.
Uh-huh.
Who, weirdly enough, turned out to be a chef. And I started to do one on Fatty Arbuckle, but it read like a fucking term paper.
Yeah.
It was so dry.
Right.
I mean, I looked at it, it's like, what the fuck is wrong with me?
Yeah.
So I just threw it out, and without telling them, I invented like this weird fake autobiography.
Yeah.
Where he's telling the story, and
yeah.
I got his voice.
Yeah.
Not hard to do when nobody's ever heard him talk.
Sure.
Kind of have a little room
yeah.
to move.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just freed me up and it just, you know, I got lucky.
It's great. It's a great one.
Oh, thanks.
And man. then the Painkillers, which I swear to God, you almost died writing that. Because, like, we couldn't write the script and I would talk to you and you'd be like, I've been up all night and I'm just writing. Like,
so sorry.
I can't, man. Like, I'm writing this. Well, we couldn't write because the strike was on.
Yeah,
but,
no,
like,
it was all happening.
But it was just sort of like this thing that it was almost like you were racing against death to get this Mengele book done.
I did have a feeling, and it sounds so melodramatic that I never talk about it, but
yeah.
I really thought, like, I got to get as much down as I fucking can.
Yeah. Well, you always write like that, though.
Well, I do now because, as like I said the other day, I'm like a lot closer to dead than 40.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So, soon to be another title. And I seem to have this need to like write with this fucking naked desperation to just keep going.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the Mengele thing was weird because I had to live in that. And it's so dark that
yeah.
you don't think it's affecting you, but it kind of is.
Yeah.
But you're kind of that dark to begin with.
Right.
So it's, you know. It's
just researching what he did in the camps?
Yeah, all that stuff. What was done, what he did, what happened to him. I mean, he fucking escaped.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
and allegedly drowned in South America, but some say he's still alive. You know,
uh-huh.
boys from Brazil. You know,
I saw that movie.
Nice, huh?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
The same kid. Hey, there's that kid again. Poor.
He did a lot of movies. Yeah.
Well, no, he's like, you know,
yeah, it's
he's
that kid.
It's the
yeah.
the Hitler kid.
Yeah.
And all these different, and like just, and who was that? Laurence Olivier as the Jew, as the Nazi hunter, the Jew Nazi hunter. Is your father home? Don't you remember?
He was. Yeah, I do.
He played Zell in Marathon Man, the Nazi dentist, and he played
is
someone.
It is it safe?
Yeah, and
is
then he played like someone based on Simon Wiesenthal in Boys from Brazil.
He just I covered. Believe. He covered all the bases.
Sure, Zell. That fucking movie's great.
Oh, it's fantastic! I love that era. I love those movies.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
When he's walking down through the Diamond District. That's him! So!
And he's got the porta blade that
oh, yeah.
shoots out of his
right
yeah.
out of his,
I mean, who doesn't want one of those?
Yeah, there's always that. Yeah. You know, you always want to have one of those when you see your first switchblade. You're like, where do you get those?
Yeah.
Mexico.
Yeah.
But, all right, so then you you do other books. And
do
you,
some
you,
more books.
You, and then you.
Massive
you,
non-sellers that I just kept doing.
But you made the big bread on the Bad Boys movies? And
yeah,
the,
I did. You know, I wrote a lot of movies where my name's not on, you know,
yeah.
a lot of those. you know, Bad Boys 2. Put my daughter through Northwestern, which is great.
Yeah.
And
you work with him for the TV shows too, right? Which one?
Yeah, some. I did some CSIs and stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, you reach this weird point, man.
Yeah.
Where you're like making good dough. Yeah. And I'm writing script after script.
Yeah, knocking them out.
And you know, I can never do it casual. I always got to like find a voice and, you know, it's a little pretentious, but whatever. But then nothing gets made. And you got to make this decision. Do I want to die with, like, you know, a great house and cool living room furniture?
Yeah.
Or do I want to fucking write some books and actually have a shelf?
Right.
You know?
So yeah.
Went for the shelf, ultimately.
Yeah, ultimately.
Know? Flunked out of show business or engineered.
We held on to the house for a while.
Yeah, it was good, you know? Yeah.
So, all right. So now, I remember when you went on the tour of the concentration camps. That was initially for a magazine article.
For Vice, yeah, I did a 6-part thing for Vice, not the video. This was the online print.
Yeah,
Vice. Yeah, they sent me over there, and I did.
What was the assignment?
The assignment was I wanted to go over there, but you know, for me, the best kind of travel was when somebody else is paying.
Yeah.
So Vice paid for me to go, but the catch was, it was a bus tour.
Right.
Of the camps.
Yeah.
Dachau, Buchenwald, and Auschwitz. So I'm riding on a bus for like, I don't know, 19 days, 18 days with a bunch of people, many of whom had never seen a Jew.
Yeah.
So that
Is
was
that true?
Fun. Yeah. But you know, we...
They're all in the book.
Some of them are in the book.
Loosely based or loosely, not,
yeah,
loosely not based. Named.
No, renamed.
Renamed,
I mean,
yes.
Well, you know, yes. I'm not an idiot.
Yeah.
But true, you know, true.
Yeah.
And... it was fascinating because the first night we're there, we're in this like kielbasa grotto, some restaurant, and we're going around the table like, why do you come? Well, you know, I've always been interested in the Jews. You know, I've seen a lot in the History Channel. And then there was a lot of Hitler's List, Freudian slip, fuck me. Schindler's List, then Hitler's List.
Yeah.
A lot of Schindler's fans. And some of whom, interestingly, were more interested in seeing the hotel where the stars of Schindler's List stayed than actual Schindler Museum.
Which camp was that he saved them from, that Schindler saved them from? Which camp was in that movie?
That is a great question.
I wonder which one it was.
I do not know. I think it was just, it was an every camp situation.
Yeah, I mean.
It was like a camp within a camp for
There's a lot
people.
Of camps that were smaller that you don't even.
Like, yeah, like
that,
Sachsenhausen, like yeah, outside like, Vienna. Yeah.
That's how you say it.
That's how I say it.
But not all of them killed Jews.
No. For example, Auschwitz was a death camp.
Right.
But like Buchenwald, they didn't outright kill them.
Yeah.
You just worked them to death.
Right.
So it's like, do you kill by like a bullet or putting instantly in the chamber, or do you work them to death?
Right. So Auschwitz was a
straight up death camp, and a Mengele experimentation center.
Really, that's where he was.
That's where he did. You know, he sewed twins together.
And that's where Eichmann was there.
Eichmann wasn't specifically at the camp. He designed the entire program, if I understand.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was a planner.
Mm.
Yeah, they got him.
So this is sort of like the arc of this book, which I think is honest, and is that your own self preoccupation with your problems as you move through these, you know, Jew killing.
Yeah, one thread is the horrible truth.
Yeah, which
that
is
you want to go and you want to feel this.
Yeah, yeah,
you really want. And
sure.
It's like I begin to think that any emotion is unworthy. Of like what these people went through. B, I got my own shit going on. And inappropriately, being a human, you know, and plus you're seeing humanity. I mean, you know, my first day in Auschwitz, you know, there was a selfie situation where these young girls, I think they're Filipina young ladies, they came running up to like, Grandma! And they thought I was Michael Richard.
Oh, really? Is that true?
Yeah. So on one level, it's creepy on, like, let's look at this.
Yeah.
Mortified that I look like Michael Richard.
I don't see it, but okay.
Then B, that I'm even thinking about that.
Yeah.
And C, what is the etiquette? They want to do a selfie. I don't speak their language.
Yeah.
Emily Post never covered that. So I just did a selfie.
As Michael Richard.
As a celebrity.
Sure.
Who I am not.
Yeah.
And they were happy. And then I go back and the people from my group are like looking at me like, the fuck is wrong with you?
Right.
You know,
have a little respect.
Yeah. But, you know, the selfie quotient, everybody's doing selfies.
Well, yeah, that's what people do.
But, I mean, it's they had to put a sign up like, you know, no Pokemon.
Oh, in Auschwitz?
Yeah.
Or one of them?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so that some people were wandering around
looking for like ratatat, ratata, or whatever the fuck it is. It's just, but then you realize, well, you get there and you're going for this emotion and it is there. You know, you've seen the pictures, you know, now you're there. But then the first thing you see is the Auschwitz snack bar.
Right.
With like these people, you know, dressed for like, you know, fun day at Orlando Disney World.
Right.
Having a slice and a Fanta.
Right. Oh, they have that there. They pizza at Auschwitz?
They have pizza. Pizza at Auschwitz, alternate title.
I imagine that these places, they all have to have some, they are memorials to some
degree. Museums. Museums. On some level.
Okay, okay.
But you were on the place where the crime happened.
Yeah.
You know, you're essentially, you know, trudging around a crime scene. And I always had this sense.
One of the biggest.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, America's founded on a crime scene. So they've always been here.
I think the scope of it, like, I also think that there's something about, and I think the book speaks to it a little bit, that it is impossible to wrangle, you know, an empathy that wouldn't kind of destroy your entire sense of morality.
Yeah.
You know, that.
That's a good way to put it.
Like, because it's so overwhelming. And your brain, when presented with something like that, is just going to, you want to focus on your own problems or on pizza or what's immediately going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's how do you meditate on realities
exactly,
of genocide?
That's exactly right. And it's so profound and so real and so soul crushing. But I got off the bus.
Yeah.
And I really had to pee.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and you can see the guys on the tour buses of a certain age.
Yeah.
The prostators.
Sure.
You know, just making a beeline.
Sure.
Cutting right in.
Yeah.
To like the Auschwitz toilet.
Right.
Where I had one of my first of many revelations where it seemed like the only thriving industry in Poland were like toilet attendants.
Oh, really? You know, they were there?
I didn't know if you paid on the way in or the way out.
Oh. It's a tip, and usually it's after you wash your hands, I think, is the etiquette on that.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
I thought I had to pay to get in.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Maybe you did. I don't know
and
how
then,
it works there.
You know, I'm surrounded. You know, what I did was I got pee shy.
Oh, yeah?
So I couldn't go at that one.
Why, the guy was standing there? Did you think you didn't tip him enough?
I don't know. You know, it's like, I just kept thinking, like, if there was no Holocaust, this guy wouldn't have a job.
Uh-huh.
You know?
The pee guy.
Yeah, and is he, like, third generation, fourth generation? You know, did his great-great-grandfather hold Himmler's helmet?
Yeah, maybe.
You know, while he...
Well, there's that. Those are good questions, too, about the legacy of the whole thing. Like, how many generations back? Who was part of it? You know, are they still here?
Well, it's funny you say that. And this is something that I experienced, and maybe you've experienced if you've been to Germany or Poland.
I haven't.
You're like having breakfast at this, you know, buffet and looking at some 95-year-old, you know, bulbous-nosed monster who's like giving you, you know, I feel like, is he giving me stink eye?
Sure.
And there's no way not to think, you know, like 70 years ago, 80 years ago, when this guy was a teen, he was like bayoneting Jewish babies.
Yeah.
You know? And
could have been.
It's impossible not to think that. So if you're a paranoid, it's a great place to be, the Jew killing countries, because you really feel like, you know, any of these guys.
You've never felt more Jewish.
Absolutely. Well, it's like my grandfather used to say, if you ever forget you're a Jew, a Gentile will remind you. And it is never more powerful and profound than out there.
Yeah. Those are the worst kind of Gentiles, the Nazis, I think. That's established.
Well, as people used to say about George Wallace, at least you know where he stands.
Yeah.
You know?
Was there something that was like, there were moments, because I remember in the book, there's definitely moments where you actually felt what you're supposed to feel.
Oh, absolutely.
And then by judging by all the research you did and the rabbit holes you're in, and also, you know, what seems to be happening in this country, the possibility of it seems a little too possible.
Yeah, it's actually and painfully true. It was right you know, in the dawn of the Trump era.
I know.
So it felt less like visiting the past than visiting the future.
Yeah.
You know, with Jews will not replace us, you know, the Proud Boys, the whole upfront, in-your-face, Trump-released anti-Semitism. I mean, he's just a symptom.
Yeah.
But, you know, thanks to him, on some level, this shit was unleashed. And here we are. And, you know, whether it's from Roe on down, the Christian nationalist state is fucking here.
Yeah, it's well underway on, you know, state governments and now the Supreme Court. And then just kind of radicalized grifting motherfuckers that don't give a shit and large corporate business interests that don't give a shit.
Yeah, but you know what? Guess who made a lot of money too? The fucking Nazis.
Yeah, I know.
You know, they were grifting. They were stealing shit from all the apartments and houses they took over, and they got all that art, stored it in a fucking salt mine.
Well, you know. What the real question becomes is, like, when does othering become murderous? Do you know, like, because, you know, if in the sense of, because you think about, like, well, people are so capable. Like, when you look at pictures of lynchings, there's 100 fucking white people standing there posing, kind of smiling. It looked like a picnic.
Yeah, I got a postcard once that I bought somewhere, and it was showing, you know, the guy's smiling and waving, and that it's so grotesque. But guess what? That could totally happen now.
Well, yeah, we're just like groups of people just kill people.
Well, you know, that's the interesting revelation I had that I didn't know I was going to have, which is like the Holocaust is not the exception.
Yeah.
The Holocaust are the rule. And, you know, be grateful you're living in a time between because the axe is always falling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a nice way to go out. It's uplifting.
Like to leave you feeling positive.
No, I love the book, and I'm glad we kind of got the whole thing going. Got the big talk.
I think we covered it.
Do you feel like you feel good about it for now?
I couldn't feel better.
I mean,
it's so great talking to you.
It's good to see you, man.
Good to see you, man.
There you go. 999, One Man's Tale of Depression, Psychotic Torment, and a Bus Tour of the Holocaust. It's available now wherever you get your books. All right? So, all right, look, here's what I want to do right now. I want you people to hang out. And if you do, you'll hear some previews of what's happening next week on the show and some other closing thoughts and some guitar. Just hang out. Okay, look, here's what's happening. On Monday's show, I've got Naomi Ekperigin. I knew her. I met her once when she was guest hosting Two Dope Queens. I believe I was on the show with her, and that's where I met her. But then I kind of knew her from her stand-up. She was a writer on Broad City, totally biased with Kamau Bell. I never really had a long conversation with her, but I knew her, and we met, and so that's going to happen. That's going to happen on Monday. You can hear me talking to Naomi Ekperigin. It was nice. It was a good talk. I enjoyed it. Today, I interviewed Orny Adams. Now, many of you know that I have a weird history with Orny Adams. And I don't know if it was resentment, but I've been awfully hard on him because he bothered me. It was just a personal thing. There was no foundation for it. It was not, based in anything that he deserved. But I've been a dick to him for decades. And I'm like, all right, well, I should talk to him. It's time to talk to him. So it turned out to be one of the great kind of comic conversations that this show is built on. If you don't know Orny Adams, many of you might know him from the documentary Comedian, about Jerry Seinfeld. Orny was the annoying guy in that, kind of the villain of that documentary. And we talk about that and the impact that had on his career and people's impression of him. It was heavy, man. It was heavy because he didn't know what to expect. He knows me and he knows, obviously, he's not completely so self-involved that he wouldn't know that I was kind of a dick to him. But he showed up. He showed up. And I knew he would. Why wouldn't he? Huh?
He didn't know what was going to happen, but he showed up. So that's coming up. It's something to look forward to if you like what this show is. Next week for WTF Plus subscribers, we'll be playing part of my town hall show from last November. That was a big deal. That was a show that I put together, the new hour that I'm working on now. That was the first big shot of it. I got the New York Comedy Festival. I got the gig to perform at town hall, and I set my sights on building a new hour post-COVID, post-Lynn's passing, to perform at town hall, to do it there. And I did one show there, and I'm going back there this December to shoot my HBO special. So I'll be at Wise Guys in Las Vegas Friday and Saturday, July 15th and 16th. It's next week. I'm back at Dynasty Typewriter for two shows, Saturday and Sunday, July 23rd and 24th. I'll be at Just for Laughs in Montreal for my gala on, or gala, however you want, on Saturday, July 30th. I'll also be doing solo shows up there, July 28th and 29th. They haven't been advertised yet. Then I've got a lot of dates coming up. I've got dates in August and September in Columbus, Ohio, Indianapolis, Indiana, Louisville, Kentucky, Lincoln, Nebraska, Des Moines, Iowa, Iowa City, Iowa, Tucson, Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, Boulder, Colorado, and Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Then in October, I'm in London, England, Dublin, Ireland. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for all dates and ticket info. Now I'm going to do something I don't usually do. I'm going to sing a song, and I'm allowed to because it's public domain. It's also one of the my favorite songs ever. I just love the melody of it. It became sort of a, I think, kind of a protest song at some point. I think it's a spiritual song, historically coming out of the slave spiritual tradition, I believe. And Taj Mahal and Ry Cooder covered it, and I just love it. So here's a few verses of it.
Sanctified and holy, I shall not be moved. Sanctified and holy, I shall not be moved. Like a tree planted by the water.